This is the final interview, number 5, with Ernestine Kettler on March 21st, 1973. This interview was to pick up some details and clarify any confusing points in the previous interview. We begin with some clarification about Emerson's arrests and her involvement politically at this time. Much of the interview focuses on her ideas about feminism in the early days. We discuss the feminist activities in Greenwich Village and her connection with feminists such as Crystal Eastman, Henrietta Rodman, etc. Her own definition of feminism and how it related to the other ideas in her life is pursued in some detail. Efforts were made to gain some information about her involvement in birth control. The story told in a previous tape about the policeman looking at her letter, which contained birth control information, was clarified, and her own familiarity with birth control was discussed. She herself apparently never did use any form of birth control and did have an early abortion in 1918. She could not, however, remember any details about this abortion, neither the way in which she contacted the doctor who performed it nor the procedure itself. Also discussed were the feelings about what's happened to women since suffrage and the kinds of societal changes in attitudes and the earlier attitudes of men towards women.
Now, this goes back to Seattle and when you were with Emerson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he was arrested once on the pornographic charge.
Yeah, he was arrested twice, of course.
Now, then the second time...
No, the first time he was arrested charges of... I just don't know how they even figure the charges of being recording secretary to the Young People's Socialist League. And they took all my accounts, my recording book and anything else that I may have had, and arrested him on that, and the lawyer told the judge that this was not possible, that I was the one who was recording secretary, and that it's actually more of a social organization than a political organization bound to destroy capitalism, and that their meetings are innocent. And that Emerson was incorrectly arrested. The police wanted something on him just so they could bring him to court and get him a jail sentence. And they picked on that stuff. And the lawyer succeeded, and the judge threw the whole case out of court.
Now,
the second time they got him was on the pornographic business. And... as I said, I didn't miss the negatives of those nude pictures of me. Well, they were coming to the apartment, I don't know for how many months after our marriage, looking for stuff, looking for incriminatory information so they could arrest Emerson. They wanted him, they didn't want me.
Now, do they seem to be after the Socialist or the IWW records in trying to get him? They were trying to get the IWW
records? Yeah, they were trying to get any kind of information that would incriminate him and make him subject to arrest. They weren't very bright. The policemen are not always bright. In fact, I don't know when they are bright. Even reading newspaper accounts of them, they don't sound bright to me, you know. And so they picked on anything that they thought might incriminate him. And the first thing that they picked on, were my records of the Young People's Socialist League.
Now, was this when the, right about the time the Palmer Raids, it must have been, wasn't it? Those began in about November of 1919.
I think that was later. I don't know. See, I tell you frankly, I don't even know what year I married.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose I have the information someplace.
Well, that's kind of cool.
But, well, I don't know whether it was 1919 or 1920.
Mm-hmm.
And the Palmer Raids were in 1920?
They began the end of 1919.
Well, I think that I was married in 1919 towards the latter part of the year, October or November. And I'm quite sure that it was in 1919. Not as late as 1920 was a general strike. And I can't remember what month that was.
That was in January.
In January.
Well, now then...
He was already in jail that time.
Now, he was in jail during the general strike?
During the general strike, yeah.
The general strike was, 1919, the beginning of 1919 was the general strike.
The general strike was in the beginning of 1919? Well, in that case, I hadn't met him, because I don't remember Emerson during that period. So I thought perhaps he was in jail, but he couldn't have been, because I know I didn't marry in 1918.
Well, now when...
See, I went west in 1918. And I was there at least a year before I met him, and longer than that.
Now, it was on the second charge, then, that he jumped the bail.
Yes, on the second charge, because they were going to give him at least 2 years in jail.
Now, was that under the Comstock laws or something?
I can't tell you. I don't remember. You know, this is where some of my knowledge is very lacking, extremely lacking. I just don't know.
And then...
Well, what do you mean under the Comstock laws? They were arresting wobblies all over this country at that time.
Since it was a pornographic charge, that's how they
started
to use a Comstock.
Well, I suppose.
Now, then he was arrested and then released on bail and then skipped bail.
And then we skipped bail. So he didn't go back. And actually, the bail was very little. I don't know the law looked upon it. It was only $300, so it didn't mean it couldn't have meant a big charge of any kind or a long sentence. And he had already spent 2 or 3 months in the jail, a workhouse. You know, they sent him out someplace still under the jurisdiction of the city jail where he worked, and I think he was there about 2 or 3 months. And then, before we could get the $300, we didn't have it. You know. And after that, we decided to skip town and to just forfeit the bail.
And that's when you went to the small town in the woods there?
Well, we first went to Tacoma, stayed there a few months, and then we went to Elby, Washington, which was about 14 miles from Mount Rainier. And stayed there for, I'm quite sure, a whole year.
Now, that was the first time in your life that you really led such an isolated life, wasn't it? That year in that little town?
Well, I would think so, yeah, I would think so. Because I've never lived in a little town before that. I don't think the population was more than 400, you know. Not only just in the town itself, it spread out. And that's not a town, that's a village. But I didn't suffer from it. I mean, you know, when you're in a small village, you get to know everybody, and you meet everybody, and such as it was, we had some kind of a social life. Then we had friends that would come there and visit us occasionally from the city. I don't know why Anna Louise Strong didn't come to visit us. I'm saying this facetiously and a little maliciously. I didn't like Anna Louise.
What about people like Kate Sadler? Did you know her?
Well, I think I met her. I don't know whether she was there or back east. But I think I met her, but of course I've known about her for years, you know, for quite a few years, in the late tens, you say, you'd say, early 20s. But if I met her, I don't recall. I didn't really know her in a real sense, you know. But of course she was very familiar to me, as were other Wobblings whom I had not met, mm-hmm. you know, but knew about.
Now, when you told me the story about the birth control, about the letter that you'd written to somebody,
yeah.
Now, was that before you married Emerson? Or was
while we were after we had married and had this apartment, and as I say, we were constantly badgered by the police, you know. They'd come in there, knock on the door with their, I think they had a metal ring, you know, you could hear it and you could tell that was the police. And they'd just look around. I tell you, I just wanted to shoot some of them because they had such gall, you know, that look in your closet and they see any papers, they take them out. They look at the books, you know, and they go through all the books to see if anything was hidden in them, and then they looked through the drawers, and I had a habit of writing and not finishing a letter and mailing it so that anyone who was curious could would get an idea of how I wrote and what I wrote about and how I thought. So, and this policeman got hold of this letter, and it just dawned on me that it was on birth control, and that birth control dissemination of such information was subject to arrest. And I didn't know what to do, and suddenly I decided I'd talk so much and so fast that he wouldn't be able to get the gist of the letter. And I succeeded. He did not get the gist of that letter, although he read it from the first page to the last page.
Now, was it describing specific contraception?
Well, whatever I knew, it was really subject. I was subject to arrest if he had been a bright policeman, because I gave information as to what to do from whatever knowledge I had at that time.
Now, where did you get your knowledge?
Oh, my God, we all had it. You know, it's not a question of where specifically I got my knowledge. But we all had it, you know, and it was, and we spoke very openly about it. And there were pamphlets written on the subject, and I don't know whether I ever went to hear Sanger or not. But she was as known to Miller in that sense, you know, that both these women were public figures, and you just knew both their ideas and their names. And if you are lucky to have read something, some biography, maybe their life history. So it wasn't any special place that I got it. We all got it from the same source. Mm-hmm. And what that source is, actually, is reading. We were great readers. You know.
Now, where did you get the contraception that you yourself would use?
I didn't use. I had an abortion when I was quite young. And I didn't get pregnant after that. That was the end of it.
But you never used anything.
I never used any contraceptives, so that I couldn't speak for myself. You know, I mean, this is not a matter of what I did personally, but what I knew and thought personally.
Can you tell me, Christine? Could you tell me, since you brought up the abortion, one of the things I'm trying to gather is more and more information as I talk to women about the kind of birth control they use, the accessibility of the information, if they had early abortions, because this... I don't really remember.
What was the first type of contraceptive? Well, they used pessaries, didn't they? And diaphragms, and I think they're pretty old. But I don't think they had them at that time. They might have had pessaries.
I don't remember.
You
never used the pessary, though.
I never used anything. But if I did, I would remember, mm-hmm. you know.
was your abortion?
My abortion was, 1918.
That would be in Washington?
That was in Washington, yeah.
And was it done by a doctor?
Oh, yes.
Now, how did you go about...
I should say, really, what happened, the abortion, I forgot, was done in New York City. But I had an operation in Washington in 1918, and that was the end of my getting pregnant.
Oh, so you were sterile after that?
Yeah. But you see, I wouldn't know what I probably had just read something on what to use as a contraceptive, and I had received a question about it from somebody in the Middle States, perhaps from a sister-in-law. And so I was writing her and giving her what information I had.
Now, how did you go about locating the doctor for the abortion? Was that very difficult? Do you remember?
I don't know. See, I don't remember. I don't remember.
So you don't remember much about
just
abortion?
I don't remember much about that. It was a, I don't know how I located him, but I did. And it was illegal, you know. But the operation in Seattle, I don't know how I found the doctor either, but I had the operation. And those things I don't care to discuss over your cassette.
The general strike, you don't remember anything about.
The what?
The general strike then in Seattle. You said you didn't remember anything about that.
Well, I remembered, I wouldn't say I didn't remember anything about it, but I'm not informative. I don't have much information. I don't know, it's the kind of mind I have. It's more abstract than concrete, you know. But I know that the strike was one of the greatest strikes in the country. In fact, it was, because as far as possible, it was a complete strike in the entire city of Seattle. Now, how many days it lasted, I don't remember.
It was 5 days.
Well, I was just going to say, I think not more than 5 days. In certain industries, it lasted 7 days. And I know, for instance, that hospitals were not struck, you know. And I think the water and power, the lights were not struck. But the power for transportation was struck. They couldn't run the streetcars. And if they had automobiles, I don't remember them, they probably did. And because the oil stations were struck, everything was struck. You know. And there was a howl in the whole city, because the restaurants were struck and the food markets were struck. You couldn't get anything. You could get food by going to certain strikers' places, special places, and you could get food over there. But the strike in itself was almost a complete strike, you know, and very effective, so effective that they settled it in 5 days, and I'm surprised that it even lasted that long. But the thing is that there were other parts of the strike that were settled before the 5 days, like the hospitals. Not that they settled it, but they returned power to the hospitals within a few hours after the strike took place. The hospitals had, I don't know whether at that time it had its own energy or not, its own power or not, I don't remember. I don't think so, I don't remember. Or I didn't know. But the strike was extremely effective, and very frightening industrial barons, as we call them, and to the manufacturers, and to the city government itself, because they had no... See, this was the first experience that they had with a complete strike, and it was so effective that it's frightened them. They just couldn't afford to have it last any longer, and they couldn't afford another similar strike. But what Seattle hoped was that other cities throughout the country would follow its example and strike also and make it a national general strike, but it didn't happen.
Now, did you participate in any of the food distribution or anything?
I must have. You know, I just don't remember. I don't remember. That seems to be a kind of a blank to me. You know, I see, if I take certain things for granted, I don't remember them. If somebody begins to recall portions of it to my mind, I might remember, but I'm not sure, because I had noticed previously that some people would remember incidents in my early life when I was there, and I couldn't remember them at all, as though they never happened. But I think that this was that I didn't suffer from it, in other words. And I imagine that we're more inclined to remember when we suffer.
Now, you know,
of course, I was, I don't know, to some degree active in it. I used to go to the Central Labor Council every time they had meetings there. And so I knew a good deal about it. One of the things that I haven't read any book on it since, but one of the things that I thought was most intriguing was that the IWW section of the strike, and perhaps the socialists, the radical elements, opposed U.S. intervention in Russia after the revolution. And because they also put out leaflets calling it, was it, workers and peasants strikes, you know, the very words that were used in Russia. And there was some, even there's some Soviet ships in the harbor, you know. Yeah, see, this is all disconnected because I don't remember exactly how they were all tied in together. But it wasn't just an economic strike, it was also highly political.
Now,
and that incidentally, as I said, I haven't read any books on it, and I don't know to what degree that has been mentioned, you know. But it was really an economic and political strike.
Now, when you went to the Central Labor, this was at the Labor Temple then?
It was in the Labor Temple, yeah.
And you went to their weekly meetings?
Well, I went to all of the meetings.
I
was extremely interested. No, I sat in the visitors' gallery upstairs. But I was extremely interested in all that was being said, all they were fighting about. And boy, they were fighting mostly. But the interesting part of it is it was a very radical council. There are a lot of IWWs and socialist delegates in it, and they were able to put through resolutions. For instance, you know, after the Russian Revolution, supporting the Soviet Union, in support of the Soviet Union, and many similar radical resolutions. Russian Revolution was a very radical idea in those days. It was the first socialist revolution in the world that has taken place, you know, and all human existence. And this was very exciting to wobblies and to socialists who were also fighting for the same thing in this country, you know, a similar revolution. But they had a lot of false ideas as to how a revolution would be conducted in this country. It was hardly comparable to Russia, with its still its backward economy, you know, and its semi-feudalist structure. I mean, the revolution could take place in such countries, but not in a technically developed country.
Now, on the Labor Council, were there any women as delegates on the Labor Council?
Oh yeah, yeah, I think so. As I recall, there were some women, maybe. No, I think there were some women. there were some unions where composed largely of women, but I don't know how far anti-feminism was affected at that time. I don't remember. And it's funny, you see, this is where some of my own revolutionary zeal ceases to be revolutionary, because I should be the first to criticize any discrimination of that nature at any time in my life, you know. And yet I didn't do it. And for the life of me, I don't know why, you know. Now, the vote struck me as very undemocratic, you know. But there was such a lack of democracy regarding women. I fought in it. I would have continued in that organization. And yet I didn't. The trouble is that I really wasn't political. I was in a political group. But amongst them were writers, were artists of one kind or another, musicians, teachers, the professional type of people with other interests besides politics. So that really my interests were fragmented. And I really didn't choose politics until almost recently.
Well, did you, that's one of the things I wanted to go into at length, was that whole early notion of feminism. Because at this time, there was a group of feminists in Greenwich Village, like Crystal Eastman and Ida Rao and all of those women.
And I knew them.
Now, you knew all of, you were involved in that circle, weren't you?
Well, I wasn't involved in their circle, but I knew them.
Now, did you define your, did you use the word feminist in those days, do you recall?
I don't remember. Mm-hmm. I really and truly don't remember. I think so. I don't know what other word could they have used.
Because some of the women, of course, who were not radical, just talked about being a suffragist, but because they didn't have a larger feminist vision.
Well, you see, what women, and both men and women, seem to have taken thousands of years to understand that there was a rupture between the male and the female sex, that women were assigned certain jobs and men were assigned other jobs, and then this and that this assignation of jobs developed, or out of it developed, this idea of male superiority. The man was taller, was stronger, was brawny, could beat the woman unconscious, you know, and actually enforce her. But this is the way the human race has always acted. You know. In all the tribal wars, whoever the victor had a perfect right to humiliate and subjugate the losers. And this is the way their attitude was towards women. And this is what women have failed to understand. The vote was nothing, you know, even the men had it. And the men misused the vote, and the women misused the vote. And this is one of the misfortunes of a democracy in which people can't judge, have no way of judging what would be to their benefit and what turns out to be to their lack of benefits, you know, to their loss. And this is what I said, you know, I mean, this is the way I have always thought in those terms. But I didn't, my group of anarchists and wobblies and socialists, the women especially, thought as I did, but the men, to an extent they did. But to a large extent they felt very superior to the female sex. You know. Women were still not in the forefront of the, as writers or as artists or as philosophers or as teachers, you know. And women themselves wouldn't go to the forefront. There were very few women like George Eliot, you know, or what is this other one in France? I can't think of it. Who wrote The Rose is a Rose is a Rose?
Oh, Gertrude Stein?
Gertrude Stein. There are very few such women. And they were unusual in the sense that that we mistakenly say they are like men. See? But we say that because we have no other comparison. We compare one existence to another to arrive at some decision, some conclusion about them. And that is why the saying is that she's just like a man. But actually, she's not like a man. She's just like a human being with certain talents and aspirations and developments. And in that sense, both men and women have them.
Now, these thoughts are those that you had in that early...
Yes, I've always had that. Those are the only... I had philosophical ideas about feminism. And not political ones, but philosophical ones. And the political ones arose only when my political consciousness realized that it was ignorant, that I was really illiterate politically. And I began to read very rapidly, and then had a sort of joined all my thoughts together and realized that society is political, economic, philosophical. It's, in fact, all knowledge is tied up in our society, and that you can't solve one problem. You can't solve any problem along a specific narrow line, that you have to take all these ideas in consideration in order to arrive at some tolerable conclusion or solution.
Now, were you influenced at all, or did you have contact with that Greenwich Village group?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I was in it for about, 2 years, I guess, maybe longer, until I came west. I was in it about 2 years, because I came west in 1918, and I was in the village, I remember, in 1916, 1917, part of or even before 1916, I don't remember.
No, that's where the very active political, radical feminists were, isn't it? People like...
Well, as I say, they were mostly dilettantes, and they were mostly... non-political. They were just a... you see, that was the time that I was interested in the theater, and I was interested in writing. I did a great deal of writing. And I was interested in art. I was really a bohemian, you know, in the real sense of the name. And politically, the politics were sort of brought into it because you live in a political society, and because certain ideas would be expressed to which I felt offended, you know. And if I corrected them, I would try to correct them politically as well as philosophically. But politics did not play a role in my life. It was a part of the general life that I led.
Feminism
was a part of my general life. Feminism was not outstanding in my life. All of these were outstanding, but I mean, I can't pick on any one subject and say that that is the subject that has had a certain influence on me. They all had an influence on me. See, what I'm trying to say about feminism is that I did not play a distinct feminist role. I argued when the subject came up in a discussion, but only when the subject came up in a discussion. I wasn't fighting for feminism, and I don't know why. I was too young really to fight for anything. I was having a good time. No, I was really young in those days. And I was young not only just in years, I was young, I had an immaturity that enjoyed living and arguing and discussing. And actually seriousness didn't enter my life until quite a few years later.
So
I don't know when it entered my life.
The atmosphere was of the Greenwich Bohemian radical...
Yeah.
Period, then,
yes,
essentially.
Yeah, it had to be radical. I assure you, I couldn't have tolerated conservative people. We'd meet them and argue with them and go away.
Now, the Provincetown players were all tied up with the feminist issues, and people like Floyd Dell and Max Eastman were all involved in that, weren't they?
I don't know. You have to read the Liberator to find out.
Now,
he wrote to them for the Liberator at that time, but I haven't seen a magazine in years, and I suppose they're in somebody's, some university's archives.
Did you write for the Liberator at all?
No, I didn't publish anything. Oh, I published two or three poems, and nothing.
Now, were you familiar with the ideas, like Henrietta Rodman had a plan for an apartment? And was they were using a lot of Charlotte Perkins Gilman's ideas about how life could be organized so that women were freed from very rigid roles. Were you familiar with any of those ideas?
I was familiar with single tax and the 99-year lease. And in fact, a single tax county someplace in Massachusetts, the people who owned this land and leased it to those that worked on the land had sent me through college. And of course, that's how I learned something about it. But still, outside of my regular radicalism that I had. And I think I read Henry George at that time, but I don't remember it, you know.
No. When you went to Washington, did the suffragists who were there, did you talk to them at all in terms of feminism? Were they very narrowly defined, do you remember?
I don't know. That was another one of my adventures. You know, actually, I went there as an adventure. Not seriously, but as an adventure, and I became far more aware of it and conscious that going to jail is not an adventure. It's not an amusing adventure. It's an adventure, but not an amusing one, and not an entertaining one. So I had much more awareness of feminism and suffragettism after I came out of prison than I did before then. And before then, it isn't that I didn't hear about them, but I didn't become overheated about it. You see, joining organizations or getting excited or enthusiastic about certain political adventures wasn't my, what is that old expression? I can't remember. It just wasn't in my nature to do that. And I didn't understand organization until I joined the political organization, or until actually I joined a union organization. But a union organization has a sense of responsibility which you cannot escape. You have to pay your dues, you're supposed to go to meetings, and you just don't escape those, the dues paying especially. In a political organization, there is a different idea. You may or may not pay your dues. You can be expelled or suspended, or something could happen to you, but generally it doesn't. There's a lack of total responsibility and dedication, really. So those things I learned when I joined them. But in my early youth, I didn't join anything.
And you don't recall what kinds of ideas the other suffragists with you had who were involved with you?
See, the only, no.
Or if you, if
They were really liberal conservatives, you know. They were not radicals. That doesn't mean there were no radicals in the group. There were. But they were not effective, and they would not spend waste of time there. Like Peggy Johns, who was a socialist or an anarchist or was a radical, she certainly didn't go back or didn't join them afterwards. And I don't think that the other woman who was connected to the trade union, I don't think she joined them and went back to them afterwards. It was really a conservative group of women. Many of them came from fine, rich families, you know, and with very good minds and a willingness to fight for their ideas, you know, to endure prison and the food, and to even starve if they couldn't eat the food there. And some of the women did just virtually starve. They lost quite a bit of weight in jail. But you see, women like that are not only dedicated, having come from a well-to-do home, food was an essential quality to them. To me, it was a quantity. I the quality disturbed me very much, but I had to make a choice between quantity and quality. I had to eat. I had to have something to eat. And you can't live on bread, you know, at least when soup is served you. You want to eat the soup, you know. And when cereal is served you, you want to eat the cereal. And before I could eat, I had to dig out all the bugs. This is terrible. But I had to do that so I could eat the food. And you know, for about 30 years afterwards, I couldn't eat oatmeal nor soup. And I didn't, in a restaurant, not at home, but in a restaurant. Now, you just couldn't get me to eat soup in a restaurant. It just sickened me, just a mere, and to this day I keep searching for things in it. And so, mm-hmm. This is the effect, this is the lasting effect that the jail had on me. But I sure felt awfully sorry for those women. They weren't poor like I was. And they could be very choosy about their food and very demanding, and I couldn't.
But so their vision was basically just really not a broader...
No, their vision was quite limited to the voting rights for women. And the fact that Alice Paul fought so many years for the ERA, you know, it just shows that she didn't have much support, you know. Party or organization should have spread throughout the country and should have been the national organization that was organized only for about 6 years ago. But it wasn't. I didn't even know where Alice Paul was.
Until
you know, when I talked to the League of Women Voters here, if there were any other women in this area who had served time at Occoquan, they didn't know. And none of them, just simply none of them, referred me to Alice Paul. None of them. Because it would have been very interesting to correspond with her. You know? That might have gotten me interested in it. But I don't think so, because I had been asked to join the League for Women Voters, and I just couldn't stand what I call capitalist politics. I can't stand it. I have enough arguments within my own group about the last presidential election, voting for McGovern of all candidates.
Well, so you, the suffrage thing was just sort of an adventure, but that's...
Well, it was a part of my radical background, see. It was in the sense that, you know, as a radical, I believed in justice. You know, and it was very just for women to vote. It was highly undemocratic, and it was an outrage that so much opposition has been placed against getting the ballot, you know. I mean, when I think of it, to me, it's just incredible. I mean, I can't believe it. I condemn it, you know. And this is the way I felt. That's why I went down there. It wasn't just an adventure. I mean to say, since I was not a political person, it might have been taken as an adventure. But I was actually outraged that women didn't have the vote. I mean, there were, after all, as many women in the country as men. And what is this business? Why is a woman so far below a man intellectually that she's not fit to vote? I mean, those were my thoughts, but I would think the same way about other issues, and there were many other issues. And poverty was a distinct issue in those days, and so was war, so was unemployment. All the issues that crop up, that have continued throughout all human history, you know, you take them up, you just don't forget them. You take them along with you as you go from one development to another. Some people are maybe radicals today, and if they get a good job, become conservatives tomorrow. But in a sense, part of the radicalism has stuck. You know, they would be able to discuss certain issues from a liberal or even a radical point of view.